Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. While some of us were enjoying time off for July 4th, this month comes with a fresh financial picture for California, to the tune of a state budget totaling $310 billion. But a feat that involves state lawmakers and Governor Gavin Newsom came with negotiations up to the finish line, given that California is facing a $32 billion shortfall. In addition to hashing out the state's financial priorities, there's also a new chapter within the state capitol. A key transition of power took place within the California Assembly, a new speaker for the first time since 2016. That, coupled with ongoing demolition and renovations, if you've had a chance to walk past the state capitol recently, those are just a few of the headlines you may have missed within the past week or so. Nicole Nixon is CAP Radio's political reporter and joins us with more. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Okay, so what is the big picture for this fiscal year's state budget, and what were the main sticking points for the governor?
Yeah, the state's Democratic leaders say that they are really proud of this year's budget. Despite that revenue shortfall, they say they were able to protect investments in what they describe as core programs, so education, the social safety net. They continue to fund priorities like setting up universal pre-kindergarten for every child in the state, extending health care to all low-income undocumented folks. And they did those things without dipping into the state's rainy day fund. The sticking points, the big one, I think, was the proposal from the governor to streamline permitting to build new infrastructure projects. We'll talk about that a bit more, I think, later. But he really pitched this as a way to build more projects faster, draw down a lot more federal money. These are climate-related projects. And then, you know, transit funding was a sticking point as well.
So how were lawmakers able to essentially like protect key programs, add additional programs, but they were also tasked with finding a way to address a $32 billion budget deficit, which is really like a 180 from the last fiscal year. How did they manage to do this without dipping into the state's rainy day reserves?
Yeah, they did a few things. So there were some cuts, I think about $8 billion overall in cuts. They did delay quite a bit of spending to future years, so they still plan to spend on things, but they're just delaying it. And they're also shifting how some projects are paid for. So the governor and lawmakers are now working on putting about $6 billion worth of projects in front of voters next year in the form of bonds. So that means voters will probably get to decide on a $1 billion climate bond and about $4.7 billion to build behavioral health treatment centers.
You joined us in the past with the Department of Finance, given that this year is kind of unique, given the tax filing extension for many counties in California. These Californians received it, residents received it because of the storm-related disaster declarations that happened at the beginning of the year. How did this impact or even complicate the budget process and negotiations for lawmakers? Because they don't really have a complete picture, a financial picture of how much money they have to work with.
Yeah, I mean, it left a huge question mark over the entire budget process, over these negotiations. I think the state is hoping for, I think the number was about $45 billion that it does not have in its like treasury right now that it would if the tax deadline had not been delayed. So the state is hoping that that number is what actually comes in before October, which is the new tax filing deadline. There are some trigger cuts as well in case that number is not quite up to what they were expecting, with some, I think that was a housing like seismic retrofitting thing. So I guess they'll wait and see in October what those financials pencil out.
Yeah, so it wasn't like a short delay. I mean, it went from like April to October to the fall. When it comes to Republicans in both the state Senate and Assembly, they were critical of the budget, how it was negotiated. What stood out to you about their arguments?
Well, as Republicans' numbers in the legislature have shrunk, so has their influence. Democrats obviously have a supermajority. They don't need Republicans to pass most legislation or to pass the budget. Every year, Republicans object to being left out of these budget negotiations. They also object to not being just kept in the loop about the day-to-day of these negotiations or what's in the budget until there is a hearing in the budget committees and they have a chance to ask legislative and administration officials about, you know, the details.
Do they have any weight to potentially, you know, in their view, fix what they believe is a broken process?
Well, they don't. They just are so small in numbers, you know, these days. But they've talked about, you know, conference committees. This is a thing that used to be a thing when small groups of lawmakers from both parties would get together and sort of hammer out some sticking points. But these budget negotiations really happen at a very high level between Democratic leaders. And it is easy for Dems to ignore Republicans and just do what they want when it comes to the budget.
So given that state lawmakers, they were able to get the state budget, you know, through the finish line or across the finish line by, you know, the deadline, which I believe was mid-June, the governor has signed it. Is everything now a done deal, or are there still outstanding budget items that are still being worked through?
The governor has signed the main budget bill that keeps the government funded. Other, like, we call these trailer bills. They're like budget adjacent, but they, you know, aren't in part of that huge like line item bill. Those are on his desk. I believe he plans to sign this infrastructure package today.
Okay. When it comes to that infrastructure package, we've talked about it on Insight. It's a plan that the governor introduced back in May to expedite the permitting process for large infrastructure projects in California. Remind us how this package will impact and affect Californians.
Well, you might see more construction. It's meant to speed up building projects, you know, rail and highway, renewable energy projects, some water. And it does that by streamlining environmental permitting. This is already done to some extent for certain big projects like sports arenas. It also limits environmental lawsuits over these projects to 9 months when feasible. Now, that's not like a hard and fast 9 months. Sometimes that can go up to like 11 months a year, is what administration officials say. And they say that this will make a big difference. The Newsom administration's big argument here is that this infrastructure package will help California meet its ambitious climate goals that are coming in 2030, 2045. In fact, a spokesman for Newsom told reporters that this whole like argument over the infrastructure permit reform signals sort of a mindset shift in the environmental movement, that in the past, environmentalists have just said no to building things. But with the intensity of climate change and the impacts, the governor is saying yes to building things like solar farms and renewable energy to get off of fossil fuels.
And this wasn't necessarily a streamlined process within the governor's own political party. I mean, some of the party members had some pause. What was the concern that they had with this infrastructure package?
Yeah, there were a few. I mean, first with the content, mainly there were concerns that the Delta Conveyance Project or the Delta Tunnel would be included. This is obviously a hugely complicated and controversial proposal to build a tunnel to send water from the Sacramento Delta to Southern California. That was taken out. It's not in the final version. Lawmakers were also just reluctant to rush this. They like to take their time with bills. They like to give things consideration and debate. Several lawmakers said something this big and consequential just should not be rushed. Mm-hmm. It should go through the normal process. And then also some lawmakers kind of felt burned by the governor before on this sort of thing. Last year, he did something similar. He brought a package of climate bills that included keeping the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant open for a few more years and some other things like limiting new oil wells, how close they can be to homes and schools. He brought this to lawmakers late in the session. It was a heavy lift for those bills. Most of them did make it through, but later Newsom was quoted saying that he had to jam his legislature on climate bills. So some lawmakers took offense to that when they worked really hard to get those bills through last year.
Given that you think, or I mean, it's projected that he's going to sign it today, correct? The infrastructure package. You know, you mentioned the Delta tunnels. You know, were there other big notable changes that were made to this legislation in order to get it across the finish line?
Well, it went from 11 bills in the beginning is what he had wanted to 5. So it got, cut down quite a bit. It also does not include things like ocean desalination projects.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon about California's new state budget and other headlines this month. So during all of these budget negotiations, there was a key transition of power within the California State Assembly. Speaker Anthony Rendon, who is the second longest speaker in California history, he agreed to step down, pass the gavel to Assemblymember Robert Rivas after a bit of a power struggle. This was a transition that former Speaker Rendon admitted to the Associated Press that left him with hurt feelings. What exactly happened?
This all actually started more than a year ago, so it's a bit of a slow roll power struggle. It was right before Memorial Day weekend last year that Rivas went to Speaker at the time, Anthony Rendon, and said that he had the votes to become Speaker. Rendon worked over that long weekend to peel off some of those votes, and there was kind of this, they were in limbo for a bit. There was a Democratic caucus meeting that went the whole day. At the end of that, Anthony Rendon was still the Speaker. Then there were elections last year. I think both of those members were working pretty hard to elect Democrats, but elect Democrats that they thought might be friendly to them or, you know, give some campaign money and help to get some help to be speaker. After members were sworn in late last year after those elections, the caucus again met and it was decided then that Robert Rivas would be speaker, but not until now. So Anthony Rendon got the first half of this year. I think the deadline, you know, meant that he got to be involved in the budget one last time, see some things through and just have some time to actually do that transition. So officially on June 30th, Robert Rivas was sworn in as speaker.
And you did an exit interview with Rendon before he stepped down as speaker. I mean, it was a bumpy, you know, last year for him. What stood out to you about the conversation?
Yeah, you know, in the past, I think I've tried to get a little more details about what actually happened behind the scenes, but the Democrats in the legislature in the assembly have been pretty tight-lipped about, you know, what was actually spoken about in those hearings. It was in those caucus meetings, it was members only. You know, we talked a lot about Rendon's legacy, what he was most proud of accomplishing. 7.5 years is a long time to be speaker. And he's, you know, he said he was proud of passing consequential legislation like overtime for farm workers. He really got into the legislature over child care. So he, you know, over cuts to child care. So not only getting that money restored, but seeing record investments in that area, I think, was a big deal for him. But, you know, what stood out to me was that he was actually pretty chill. He seemed like a senior on the last week of school.
Yeah, maybe like had some closure, made peace with it, you know, next chapter for him. You know, you also attended the swearing-in ceremony of the new Assembly Speaker, Robert Rivas. They're both Democrats, but what stands out to you just initially about Rivas and how he will potentially lead his party within the Assembly and how it could differ from Rendon?
Well, Robert Rivas is really promoting unity. I think it was a very tough, even though Democrats aren't, you know, talking publicly about everything that went on behind the scenes here, it was pretty bruising. So he's promoting unity. He talks about his background. He was born the child and the grandchild of farm workers. He grew up in farm worker housing. So Democrats in the Assembly are happy to have somebody that represents, you know, a background in California that you don't often see at the highest levels of government. And Rivas has already made some personnel changes. He's appointed a new majority leader, a new speaker pro tem, which kind of leads the day-to-day in the assembly. He said he wants to minimize disruption, so not promoting new committee chairs in the middle of a legislative session. So, you know, as far as his leadership style, we'll have to see.
Another big headline, you've been following this one since really the beginning at the state capitol, is an update on the Capitol building itself. I mean, more than a year after lawmakers and their staff, they moved out, crews began demolishing the Capitol Annex building last week. What's next for this project?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different parts to this Capitol Annex project. One is the annex itself, which is the office building connected to the Capitol, though it was physically disconnected a few weeks ago and it has now started to be torn down. A group of opponents have sued over the design of that new annex, also the fact that the state wants to build a museum visitor center underneath.
And that's typically where people would have demonstrations and rallies, correct?
Right. So the state just recirculated, you know, the plans for public comment. That closed just a few weeks ago, and there has not been an update yet. I think we're just waiting to see whether any of those plans change based on the public feedback.
Nicole, thanks for getting us up to speed.
Thank you.
That is CAP Radio politics reporter Nicole Nixon. Up next, some California officials are looking towards Texas for solutions towards homelessness. We'll learn more about the Lone Star State's success and if it could work here at home. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California has invested billions of dollars in response to homelessness in recent years, yet the crisis is still a top concern among Californians. The number of unhoused people has ballooned to record numbers, despite funding and new or expanded resources and programs. And it touches every corner of the state, from small to large, rural to big urban centers. Collectively, we all get a front row seat to homelessness on a daily basis, feeling compassion and concern, but also despair and frustration because it can feel impossible to solve or even reduce. But that's not the case in Texas. The state is gaining notice from California elected officials about its progress over the past decade in reducing the number of people experiencing homelessness, investing a fraction of the money. Since 2012, Texas's homelessness population dropped by nearly 30%, while California's has grown by more than 40%. Marisa Kendall is a reporter for CalMatters, and Marisa took a trip to the Lone Star State to see what Texas is doing differently and if these solutions can work here at home. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So when did you first become aware that there was an interest from California elected officials to look into Texas and its homelessness resources and policies? You don't typically think of California looking to Texas for things.
Absolutely. I've actually been aware of it for a few years. It started out with my awareness of Community First Village in Austin, which is a giant, tiny home village for unhoused people on 51 acres. They have permanent housing for folks and all kinds of amenities like art studios. And they do a symposium every year where people from all over the country who are interested in replicating it come and learn about the model. So this year, I learned some local council members from Richmond, California, we're going to make the trip. So I decided I would go too and see what they learned. But then as I did research, I learned it's far more than just Austin. Houston and San Antonio are also doing really interesting and successful things to solve homelessness. And then also just the state of Texas overall is in much better shape than California.
Mm. You found that in roughly the past decade, Texas's homelessness population, it dropped by 28%, while in that same time, California's has grown by 43%. So a percentage is one metric, but is it a fair metric? So back in 2012, did Texas and California have comparable homeless populations?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Texas had a significant homelessness problem, 10 years ago. Houston had a huge homelessness problem. Today, even aside from just looking at the percentage decrease, Texas has a much smaller per capita rate of homelessness. Those numbers are pretty much the best we have, but you have to mention those should be taken with a grain of salt as well. They come from the point in time count, which is basically a visual count that volunteers do one night, either every year or every 2 years, eyeballing how many homeless people they see. So it's not an exact science.
And that is something that is a federal mandate. I mean, we have a point in time count here in Sacramento, and I believe, big cities or cities across the country are required to do so, or continuums of care.
Correct.
Were you surprised when you arrived in Texas, just, you know, kind of getting a lay of the land, walking around, did you visibly see a difference for yourself when, you know, when you're talking or thinking about homelessness? Was it visible walking around a large city like Houston compared to Los Angeles or San Francisco?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's important to note, you know, Texas and Houston have not solved the problem, right? There still are encampments. There still is homelessness. It's still a big problem. In Houston, what I did see a couple years ago, they started a push to clear encampments that has been, a lot of people say, pretty successful for those encampments. They do outreach. They move everyone from one encampment at a time into either housing or into a brand new, pretty nice navigation center. So when I was there, what I did see as I went around was a lot of places where encampments used to be that are now completely cleared. They're fenced in. There are not tents there. In some places, a few tents had come back. But there were a lot of places where you could see that progress, but there still were a lot of encampments that they still had yet to get to.
How does the progress that has taken place in Houston, how does it compare to progress that's been made of getting people out of homelessness here in Sacramento or other cities?
Yeah, I think just one of the big differences in Houston is they actually are able to house people much more effectively and much more quickly. Part of that is everything's just cheaper in Houston. The rents are much cheaper. They build a ton more housing. They have a lot fewer regulations that can stymie housing production. Texas overall has a much higher vacancy rate than California, 10% compared to 4%. So in Texas, you are seeing them just having more success moving people from the street into housing or moving people from this new shelter navigation center I mentioned into housing. Something like 95% of the people Houston moved into this navigation center then went on to housing. You compare that to San Francisco's biggest navigation center, 8% of people go into housing.
Yeah, so that is sizable, because in your reporting, you found that Houston's homeless population dropped nearly 60%. In the last decade, where, you know, places like here in Sacramento County, according to the point in time count, it spiked to like 230%, and LA counties, Los Angeles counties jumped over 100%. Is Texas or these cities, are they spending the same level of money as California?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Their funding is very different. Texas as a state, they spend hardly any state money on homelessness. As a state, they're spending about $800 per unhoused person compared to California, spending almost $11,000 per unhoused person. And it depends on the city as well. Houston spends no city money on homelessness. So that is a hurdle that their providers have to overcome. But to compensate, they get an outsized portion of federal funds. So in 2021, Houston received about $14,000 in federal funds per unhoused person in that area, compared to, say, Sacramento County got about $3,000. So they're really cleaning up in terms of the federal funding.
Why are they getting more federal funding?
Houston says it's because they're doing a really good job, and the federal government sees that, and they are compensating them accordingly.
But in the end, when it comes to the dollar amount, California is spending billions of dollars on this with a B. Is Texas spending, whether it's from federal funding or local funding, are they actually spending billions of dollars on this, or is it just a fraction of what California is spending?
Well, because the state funding is really non-existent, it's really hard to tell because it's a patchwork of different cities spending or federal government intervening. So it really depends. But I think it's very fair to say California is spending a ton on this problem. It's our number one priority. It's everyone's top concern in surveys, and they're not getting the results that people would like to see.
You also spoke with nonprofits and advocates for homelessness, you know, in Texas. One of them is Mike Nichols with the Houston Coalition for the Homeless. We're going to listen to part of the conversation that you had with him in Houston, but what stood out to you about what's working for him?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I heard again and again when asking people why Houston has been so successful is they said collaboration. They do a really good job of the county, the city, and all the different nonprofits, and even some of the private sector working together to solve the problem. And that is not always the case in California. Like LA County, for example, they have four different groups, government groups that request federal funding. And that's just not the case in Houston. You have a much more coordinated approach. Mm-hmm.
So more collaboration.
Exactly.
Or effective collaboration. So a big focus was on permanent housing. That's what you've touched upon, versus temporary housing, which includes shelters. So let's listen to Mike explaining why that is important, permanent housing.
It costs our community about $18,000 in federal funds to house someone for a year. That's for the services and the subsidy for the rent. The exact cost of keeping somebody on the street is astronomical, probably five or six times that because of emergency health care and cleanup and other items. The cost of putting someone in jail, which sadly about a third of our people at the county jail self-report as homeless, cost about $35,000 a year. But again, the success of focusing on the housing and focusing on the most vulnerable people going to housing first is both morally responsible and fiscally responsible.
Okay, so given that permanent housing is just more, it's cheaper, but it's also more successful for someone experiencing homelessness, we know that that is a model that California wants to lead with, right? Like leading with a housing first model. But there are big differences between Texas and California. You touched upon Texas has more availability for housing. It is a cheaper state. Is it realistic to compare Texas to California in terms of permanent housing as a major difference within this state?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, Houston, they traditionally don't spend any public money on temporary housing, on homeless shelters. And that's a big difference in California. And that's a point of contention. You have a lot of temporary housing programs in California. Even take San Jose, for example. The mayor there caused a lot of controversy recently because he tried to divert a significant chunk of money from permanent housing into temporary housing. But you really can't do things exactly the same here as in Texas, because in Texas you do have more permanent housing availability. And here it's so limited that people argue you need a place for folks to go in between while they're waiting. So that's why here you have a lot more, you know, temporary tiny homes and temporary shelters, because people argue, well, you need to get folks off the encampment, out of the encampments, and put them somewhere while they wait for this permanent housing. But then the problem becomes, when you have no permanent housing for them to go to, people sometimes languish in these temporary solutions that are not, you know, up to par.
So it seems like in Texas, at least, you know, we're hearing from Houston, like they all are collectively are just going all into permanent housing. And as a consequence, they don't really have as many, you know, temporary shelters as California has, whereas California has more of a patchwork of housing solutions.
Yeah, exactly. And that, I mean, that also poses a problem for Houston, because even though they have more housing, it's not like people can be housed instantaneously. So they do sort of neglect the shelter aspect. And as a result, I did meet people, you know, who were on the housing wait list. They'd been waiting for months and they had nowhere to go. In the meantime, you know, they were sleeping straight up on the sidewalk with no tent or anything like that.
And how do you stay in touch with people if they say that they are interested in permanent housing, but there isn't a shelter or to find them in? I mean, that's typically a great access point to stay in touch with someone. How do you actually find them?
It's really tough. They have a day center there, which is where I met some of these people, where folks go for breakfast and lunch and to shower. And some of those folks go every day and they get on the housing wait list there and they check in every day. But then sometimes they do just disappear. So, you know, there's no beds there. They need to sleep somewhere. That's why their new Houston's new model of that one navigation center, they say, has been working really well, because you get everyone there. Folks can really just relax there, focus on getting their lives back together, getting their minds right. And then their caseworkers know where they are, and they're not missing when their name comes up on the housing wait list.
One of the people who's waiting that you spoke with is Rachel Gonzalez. And so let's listen to her journey.
So I've been waiting since November. And sleeping here outside in the streets.
Do you think you will get housing?
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to be anytime soon. You know, and this sleeping outside sometimes can really get to you, you know. Like maybe in a month, you got to think day by day. You can't think about tomorrow, because if you think about tomorrow, think about a week from now, you'll actually go crazy.
How did Rachel deepen your understanding of Houston's approach and challenges to homelessness?
Yeah, her story was difficult to hear because she was just so frustrated and discouraged with the process. You know, she was coming into this day center every day, getting breakfast and lunch, doing her laundry, getting a shower. And she signed up for housing with a caseworker through the center. And she told me she was asking, you know, every day or at least once a week, so what's my status? And they would just tell her, oh, you're on the list. You just have to wait. And it's such an opaque process. It's not like they tell you what number you are on the list and when your number might come up and how long you might have to wait. So she's just waiting with no real word. And then when the center closes, she just goes across the street and she just sleeps on the sidewalk because there aren't those shelters. And, you know, Houston and Texas in general, they do enforce anti-camping a little bit more than we do here in California. So there's not really, she doesn't really have a tent or an encampment to go to. She just is on the bare sidewalk.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CalMatters reporter Marisa Kendall, who traveled to Texas to learn how the state shrank its homeless population and what it can teach California. But as the big picture, Texas has dropped its homeless population by roughly a third, while California's has grown. When you talk to Mike Nichols, he touched upon this collaboration that takes place within nonprofits and local officials. And Mike Nichols is with the Houston Coalition for the Homeless. So let's hear his explanation about the value of collaboration across homelessness efforts.
I urge the cities and counties in California to work together, to put their egos aside. I'm convinced even in a city like Los Angeles, even in a city like San Francisco, with the right collaboration, the right funding, the right support, the right pragmatism, you will be able to house 85% of those people who are living on the street.
And Houston's home to 2.2 million people, and within the past decade, it reduced its homelessness population by 60%. What stood out to you about the collaboration in a big city like Houston compared to other cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the collaboration is a really important piece because generally, in a homelessness response system, different entities are responsible for different services. You know, often the city is responsible for providing shelter beds, but the county provides all of the mental health services, right? And you really can't tackle the problem effectively unless you have all those resources working together. So what Houston was able to do in about 2012, they sort of revamped their whole approach and pulled everybody together and decided, you know, how can we collaborate? What programs can we bring together? So they got rid of some services that they thought were duplicative. They added other services. That's when that day center I was talking about added a bunch of case managers so they could actually get people into housing rather than just saying, here's a shower, good luck with the rest of your life. You know, and some counties in California do a much better job of that than others. Santa Clara County has been collaborating pretty well. For example, LA County has struggled with that a little bit, but they're sort of trying really hard right now to get that collaboration going. Some LA officials recently went to Houston to try to learn how to collaborate better. And they're working on getting a task force together that pulls people from the different branches of the county to sort of emulate what Houston is doing.
Hmm. Yeah, and it wasn't only Los Angeles. There were lawmakers or officials from the Bay Area and even Sacramento County. Supervisor Rich Desmond visited Texas. What did he learn from the visit?
Yeah, so he went to San Antonio to visit Haven for Hope, which is this massive homeless shelter that serves about 1,600 people a night. It serves almost the city's entire homeless population in one giant campus. And they basically don't turn anybody away. So as a result of that, you know, you have folks sleeping in really close quarters on mats on the floor or in bunks with a lot of people in a room. But one good aspect of that program is they have services on the campus for pretty much anything you could want in one place. So you can, there's a doctor's clinic, a dental clinic, eye care, there's a hair, you can get your hair cut. So pretty much just all the things you need to get your life back on track, you can find in this one campus rather than having to trek all over the city, which is tough if maybe you don't have a car or what have you. So he toured that shelter, as, many people have, and he came away thinking that the all-inclusive model would be a really good model for Sacramento, though, he was not able to find any place big enough in Sacramento to pull something like this off. But he said that the county has been working to sort of implement the model in smaller ways, just adding more services on a smaller scale to smaller projects.
What has the governor's office said about the comparison of California to Texas? I mean, you have elected officials going to Texas.
Yeah, it's interesting because on one hand, you could say, well, that's sort of almost embarrassing for California because Californian politicians never want to emulate Texas. They tend to have a lot of animosity towards some of Texas's policies to the point where the state prohibits publicly funded travel to Texas. But the governor's office basically said, our policies and what we're doing a lot. We compare really favorably to what Texas is doing. And they pointed out that the three main cities that I talk about are blue islands in the red state. So they basically sort of defended their policies and said, we have a lot of the similar ideals and, we're doing a ton on this issue.
Can California apply anything in kind of like a copy and paste to when it comes to Texas solutions, from your trip of traveling to San Antonio, Austin and Houston?
A few places have been successfully replicating the tiny home village that is in Austin on a smaller scale because Austin's is massive. And in California, it's just harder to find the space. But there's one in Livermore that's been there for a couple of years that has been quite successful, offering, permanent housing for folks. They've, ended a couple dozen people's homelessness. They have different services and amenities there. And then there's another one that is just being built in the San Joaquin Valley that is pretty much seeking to directly copy what Austin is doing. And, even having the, outdoor movie theater, the art studios, all of those little amenities that transform it from just your run of the mill, like homeless shelter or homeless housing, into a community where people can live out the rest of their lives.
Given that you've been covering homelessness in California for quite some time and you just got a wider perspective and comparison by traveling to another state, what do you want listeners to leave with? Because, after learning about these differences, people can leave encouraged that California can make progress because you can just look to Texas and it's happening, or they can leave more frustrated because it's like we're going in the wrong direction. The numbers keep growing despite billions of dollars being spent.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think it is. Do you want to look at it glass half full or glass half empty? I think we should look at it glass half full. Texas and Houston are proof that it can be done. It's not an impossible problem, which I think is a healthy outlook, because when you start thinking of it as an impossible problem, you stop trying to solve it. And that's what we don't want to do.
Marisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is CalMatters reporter Marisa Kendall, who traveled to Texas to learn how the state shrank its homeless population by 28% and what it could teach California. Still ahead, a global soccer tournament with a purpose beyond competition. We'll learn about the Homeless World Cup, which is taking place at Sac State this week. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Soccer is known as the world's most popular sport, with fans and players that touch pretty much every country. It brings people together, reminds us of community, and it's also an equalizer. The entry to play is simply a soccer ball, an interest in the ground. This weekend, Sac State welcomed more than two dozen countries to compete in a soccer tournament with a cause.
USA! USA!
The players have all experienced homelessness within the past year, from countries spanning Australia, Italy, South Korea, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Brazil. The Homeless World Cup started 20 years ago and describes itself as a tournament with a purpose. Players, often traveling outside their home country for the first time ever, receive inspiration and support to change their own lives, while changing perceptions and attitudes towards the global issue of homelessness. And this year is the first time in its 20-year history that the United States was selected as a host country, with competitions at Sacramento State this week. Finals are on Saturday, July 15th. Matthew Williams is with the Homeless World Cup and joins us now. Welcome.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
So let's get to the origin story. How and where did this start?
The best person to ask would probably be Mel Young, our co-founder and president. Mel is here, but he's at the stadium
right
now.
Week.
The action starts at 9 o'clock, so it's quite nice to be in a quiet interview room and away from the heat. Mel and a good friend of his, Harold Schmidt, were at a conference in 2001. And similar to your previous interviewee, they said, we need to do something about homelessness. There's not enough being done. And they were at a newspaper conference. A lot of European countries, homeless people will sell publications like The Big Issue. And they were involved and engaged. And over a beer, as these things tend to happen, they talked about involving sport. Sport, as you mentioned, has an impact. Sport, and especially soccer, as I've learned to say it over the past week.
Not football.
No, not
it's not in the United States.
I know. So soccer, football, it's a universal language. As you mentioned, anyone, you can make a ball, you can pick up a ball, you can use a tennis ball, you can use a mitre size 5 FIFA approved ball that we've got over there as well. So anyone can play football, anyone can enjoy the game and watch the game. And as you mentioned, it's here right now in the US, and the quality of the football is exceptional. So Mel and his colleague introduced the Homeless World Cup in 2003. It's actually our 20th year anniversary, but things are quite busy with the tournament right now, so we'll look at that when we get home. And they kicked off in Austria. Small amount of teams, there were 16. We've got 40 teams here in Sacramento, but we've got 72 global partners. So we're based in Edinburgh in the UK, but we've got partners, as you mentioned, that are here, but also that aren't here. It's a global organisation. We've got a global window into homelessness, and we use the wonderful game of football to talk about it. So we've been out of action for 4 years with COVID. So bouncing back in the US is good for us. The eyeballs on it is exceptional. And I think the 20th year is quite special to be doing here in the US.
What are the qualifications to play?
From a performance and playing point of view, there isn't one. So you don't have to have kicked a ball to come and play in this tournament. The rules are slightly different. It's 4-a-side, a bit like a basketball court in terms of size. So the rules really are our member countries, as we call them, the teams that are here. So Street Soccer USA, Street Soccer Scotland, Street Soccer Australia. Those guys are working all year round. They're connecting with homelessness charities in their countries. Homelessness is different in every country. In Pakistan, it could be a natural disaster. In the UK, it could be addiction. In the US, it could be mental health. So homelessness doesn't choose who it affects. So our players are isolated. When you're homeless, you're cut off from society. You haven't got the amenities that everyone else can get as well, like a shower and things like that. But playing football, again, you don't need to speak the same language. You don't need to particularly like your teammates sometimes as well, but you can play football and you become part of a team and you start communicating with people and you start talking about why that pass was bad or you shouldn't have missed that goal. And then that can lead on to, well, how's your day been? And it allows people to not feel isolated. And we are a very big reward for some people's hard work. So you need to be clean for a year before you come to the Homeless World Cup. You need to demonstrate spirit and principles which show that you are able to come and represent your country. And that's what it is. We have national anthems and our teams are kitted out. Portuguese FA give their team a kit. The Irish FA give them a cap. So yes, they're homeless. They've been homeless. They've been at rock bottom. But right now we're celebrating them as individuals. And there's no better way than doing it on the soccer pitch.
Our reporter at CAP Radio, Chris Nichols, was there for, you know, the opening ceremony this weekend. And he spoke with some of the players. You know, as you mentioned, all of the players have experienced homelessness. One of them is Yuli Pineda. She's 18 years old. She experienced homelessness here in Sacramento. And we're going to listen to a part of her conversation with Chris Nichols about the life experiences that brought her to this point.
Well, when I lived in Honduras, I was 14 years old and I decided to come here and I didn't have anyone who to come with and I come by myself and I walk here. I start walking from my house to here and I was like 6 months in the road, so I didn't have a home, but there was a lot of people who helped me. And I, thanks to God though, because I pray a lot when I was in the road and he helped me a lot. He always put somebody on my road to help me, support me, and get me out.
14 and came here all on your own.
Yeah.
Wow. And then when you got here to the United States, did you have a home? Did you have?
Right now I am on foster care, but before I come to the foster care system, I was in the shelter, so I have been everywhere.
Yeah, and that's Yuli Pineda, who's now 18 years old, but made that pilgrimage, that walk herself when she was 14 from her country to here in California. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, there are so many different circumstances that create hopefully a temporary experience of being unhoused.
Yeah, and I think my buzzword of this week has been goosebumps. I've been getting goosebumps hearing players talking in the dining room, hearing them talking on the football pitch. And that's why we have the Homeless World Cup, to hear stories like that. We need to have a platform for people to talk about how they can turn their lives around, how they can face adversity, but still continue on that path. And what she mentioned about people being put in your path and the universe being there for you, I think this week is a celebration of that. The atmosphere over at campus is incredible. Mm. So we're in the dorms. The Sac State is beautiful, and it feels like you're living in a movie, in a dream. And that's for me, who's someone who's well travelled. Some of our players have only just got passports. Some of our players haven't been on a plane, and bringing them together in this environment is great. And don't get me wrong, there's some rivals, so there's some quality on show. Mexico, Brazil, the men's USA team coached by Reed Fox pushed Mexico really hard yesterday and lost 4-3. Mexico are reigning champions, and that gets forgotten a bit sometimes because you've got all these amazing stories, but actually if you sit and watch the soccer on show, it's very impressive, and you can do that on our website. You can do that on our Facebook page as well, and you can come and watch it.
Right.
We would love to get some people into the stadium. Usually, we have our tournaments in city centres, so underneath the Eiffel Tower, Cape Town, on the beaches in Rio, and it disrupts people's day. People walk past and say, "What's happening over there?" And the conversation starts. The Homeless World Cup. I've not heard of that. These players are homeless, and they're doing this. So it's a conversation starter. So in the stadium, it's amazing for our players. but we're not getting that kind of public engagement. So please come along. It's free to watch. We're on in the evenings as of tomorrow, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then finals day, which is all of our teams have a chance to win a trophy. So all of our teams, you don't go home like the FIFA World Cup and you get knocked out and get sent home. So our teams stay till finals day, and on finals day, everyone has a chance to win a various award, and then the Homeless World Cup will be competed by our two best men's teams and our two best women's teams.
You know, we only have a minute left, but I want to end with another player that Chris Nichols interviewed. This is Sienna Jackson, and she's 24 years old. She's experienced homelessness in Sacramento as well, but is now in stable housing with a pet. And she really gets to the heart of why soccer and this world tournament is so much more than competition in a game.
This exists, one, to bring cultures together who have all been through the same thing. Just because we're in the United States doesn't mean that there's not other countries that have been honestly through the exact same thing that you have. So this tournament really brings everybody together. It gives people an outlet if they're stressed, if they've had drug addictions, if they've had partner abuse, all that stuff. They're able to come and play a common game that's known around the world to be able to communicate and relax and kind of, you know, take the ease off their shoulder a little bit. So it's a really nice feel, you know, to kind of be around everybody. And just, you know, even though we don't speak the same languages, we all understand what everybody has been through here, and we all have a level of respect for everybody. So I love what they're doing here for everybody.
And that is the perfect way to end. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us for a busy but fun week.
Thank you for having me.
Matthew Williams is with the Homeless World Cup. The Homeless World Cup is at Sac State this week. It is open to the public. And as Matthew mentioned, finals are on Saturday, July 15th. And that is Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.